This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in London, alongside Alex Steele over in New York. It is Wednesday after Tuesday. Yesterday, America voted. Today, we get the results, except that we kind of don't, Alex. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm still trying to figure out the US midterms. But aside from that, we've got equity markets that are going nowhere. The British pound is down fairly sharply. Yields have dropped fairly sharply as well across global bond markets in advance of CPI tomorrow. But the big story is Bitcoin, which a few moments ago was trading below 17,000.
Yep, we're up against that now, 17,050. But I mean, now we're just splitting hairs. There is a report from CoinDesk, which is a Bitcoin basically website, news website, that says that perhaps Binance won't actually go through with the takeover of FTX. So that's another leg lower for Bitcoin. We'll definitely talk about that and the complexities around this deal and what it means for the future of the crypto industry. And I'm really happy, Guy, that you know that Wednesday comes after Tuesday. I feel like this
honestly,
is a win for us today.
Honestly, after today, I'm questioning everything.
Right, I meant
now.
It. I meant it. This is a win for us.
Wow. What a day. Okay, let's kind of bring it all together. Let's get some headlines. Here's Charlie Pell.
Hi, thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. Indeed, happy Wednesday. Nurses in England, Wales, and Scotland have voted to strike in the biggest course of industrial action in the Royal College of Nursing's 106-year history. In a fresh blow to the UK's already strained National Health Service, the majority of nurses employed by the NHS are supporting action over patient safety concerns, and as they seek a pay rise of 5% above inflation. Many of the country's biggest hospitals will see strikes, including Guy's and St. Thomas, which treated former Prime Minister Boris Johnson during the initial stage of the COVID-19 pandemic. Vladimir Putin will not attend the Group of 20 summit next week, this according to sources, as the Kremlin seeks to protect the president from potential high-level tensions over his invasion of Ukraine. Barclays is going to refund more than 1,000 customers, an average of £750 apiece, after it failed to send them reminders of its payment protection insurance policies. And Esken Limited, the owner of London Southend Airport, has begun a strategic review that could see both the aviation arm and a biofuels unit, its other main business, offered for sale. Esken says it's going to consider all options for its operating activities. Southend is seeking to establish itself as London's sixth commercial airport. It had drawn half a dozen airlines before the coronavirus pandemic upended travel. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. Charlie Pellett, back in 30 minutes to keep us updated on what's happening with the headlines. So as I say, it's kind of the morning after the night before. That kind of is the feeling after the US midterms. The Republicans basically limping towards control of the lower house, the House of Representatives. Disappointing results for the Republicans. They look probably to take the House. The Senate is a coin toss at this point in time. This was a much closer election than anybody anticipated. There was an expected Republican wave, a red wave that was going to wash over America. It didn't happen. And that is critical and tells us a lot about where we are in terms of the political narrative in the United States. We've just got to figure it all out and understand what the implications of it all are. To help us with that, Bloomberg's Washington correspondent Anne-Marie Hordern joins us now. Anne-Marie, we were expecting a Republican wave, a red wave. Why didn't we get one?
It's a great question, and we'll be doing a lot of postmortems. But right now, as it stands, is all of these issues like inflation and the economy still number one and why people went out to vote. But clearly, people did not think that all of the Republican remarks on how they would have handled it was enough to go give them their vote. Like, there was still obviously some wins for the House, but it's going to be a thinner majority than many were expecting. And of course, we're still waiting on who is really going to control the Senate.
To that point, Anne-Marie, first of all, great coverage over the last few days. What don't we know still yet?
So the big ones is really the Senate. We're waiting on Nevada, Arizona, Wisconsin, which right now is definitely leaning towards the Republicans, and Georgia. And what makes it so interesting and maybe a bit painful is that we're actually not going to know Georgia, likely. An election official tweeted saying it's safe to say that that's likely going to go into a runoff. So we'll be doing this for another 4 weeks, basically, if Georgia does, in fact, go to a runoff election, because neither candidate got more than 50% of the vote. So this morning, what you should really be focusing on is what happens in Nevada and what happens in Arizona. And these are very tight races.
Amory, what does this mean for President Biden? He didn't do as badly as some of his predecessors in midterm elections, and he certainly didn't do as badly as expectations.
For the former president, Trump, it was definitely a loss. For Biden, you're right. It is not as bad as what is expected. And when you look at past presidents, he is doing much better in terms of what everyone says is every president loses seats during a midterm election. This is seen as a referendum on the sitting president. For Biden, this was actually the best a sitting president has done since George W. Bush and the 9/11 terrorist attacks. So the White House is feeling pretty confident in this. And it actually comes at a really convenient time for this White House, as they're about to embark on a really important trip on the global stage. They're going to a G20 at a critical time when there's a war in Europe with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and also at the same time they are really trying to combat the growing influence of China. And we are widely expecting President Biden to sit down with Xi Jinping. And now this gives that team a little bit more oomph.
And Marie, does this make Trump-Biden 2024 more or less likely?
I think less likely, because the big winner of the night was clearly Ron DeSantis. In terms of the margin he won, the Democratic strongholds that he was able to flip in Florida. And
so for our London audiences, he's a governor of Florida who's seen as Trump, but not crazy. Like, that's if you talk to anyone on the street, like, that's what they'll wind up telling you.
Yeah, sorry. For the UK audience and those in the city that might be driving home now after a long day, he is the governor of Florida. You might have heard a lot about him because a lot of the Wall Street money is definitely leaning towards DeSantis for 2024. And he clearly had the best night. And yesterday, the Wall Street Journal is reporting some comments from the former President Trump, who said, you know, DeSantis can run if he wants to run. But what he should know is that he has interesting information that's unfavorable to him that maybe only him and his wife, DeSantis' wife, know about. And I guess the former president is looking to use it. But clearly, DeSantis is starting to unnerve him. This is not the first time we've heard comments like this. They had a much better relationship 4 years ago. Now it's starting to fray. He called him the other day Ron DeSanctimonious. So this relationship is obviously one that's starting to get under the former president's skin, because this is where people are starting to lean in terms of what they're interested in for the Republican ticket for 2024.
Amory, we're going to talk about Ukraine in just a moment. Does this election have any meaningful impact on America's ability to continue to support that country?
So definitely that there wasn't a Republican wave. It does seem like that narrative will start to quell. If you look at a recent Wall Street Journal poll, by and large, Americans do want to continue supporting Ukraine, but it is a bit more partisan in the sense that on the Republican ticket, more people are questioning, should we be sending this much money to Ukraine? Kevin McCarthy is poised to be the speaker. He made this comment about there's not going to be a blank check. At the same time, he walked that back, saying, I was just calling for more accountability. But it does look like there will be this bipartisan support, even though if you hear from the fringes some questions about it, it does look like there will be this bipartisan support to send that aid to Ukraine.
All right, Amy H., thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Amory Hordern crushing it over the last few days in D.C. Thank you very much. From U.S. politics to U.K. politics. So Guy was giving me lots of explainers on your tax system. Whoa! We're going to talk more about the potential tax rises that are coming your way. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Mr. Speaker, I obviously regret appointing someone who has had to resign in these circumstances. But I think what the British people would like to know is that when situations like this arise, that they will be dealt with properly. And that's why And that's why it is absolutely right that he resigned, and it's why it is absolutely right that there is an investigation to look into these matters properly. I said my government would be characterised by integrity, professionalism and accountability, and it will.
The Prime Minister at PMQs a little bit earlier, speaking about the resignation of the former cabinet member, Gavin Williamson. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the drip, drip, drip we're getting out of the Treasury in terms of what the fiscal statement is going to look like in a few days' time as well. Let's bring in Bloomberg UK government and Treasury reporter Joe Mays. Joe, let's start off with the Gavin Williams incident and kind of put it in context of this new government. How problematic, how much damage is being done to the Sunak government as a result of his choices for cabinet? Isn't just Williamson, it's Suella Braverman as well. And it looks like it's starting to hurt.
Yeah, it certainly is damaging to the brand of this government. You know, Rishi Sunak would have wanted to have a nice, new, clean start. He promised, you know, integrity and professionalism in this government. But instead, it's been dominated by all these discussions around bullying with Gavin Williamson or why he reappointed Suella Braverman despite her having been sacked from government for a security breach. So it hasn't got off the start he would have wanted. I think that with Williamson going now, he'll want to put all this behind him and hope that we don't see more such, you know, turmoil within the party. But we know that he has enemies on the back benches, people he's fired from the Liz Truss administration. So I think this could be a theme carrying on the weeks ahead.
So is he going to distract everyone by just hiking taxes instead?
Well, if anything, these dramas have somewhat helped in that it's taken the focus away from the kind of economic pain he's going to have to meet out on November 17th.
So he'd rather talk about that than hike taxes.
Yeah, probably so. I mean, they're both pretty bad, right? So it's not ideal.
Okay, let's talk about the drip, drip, drip. How what do we know about what is going to be announced here? Are these trial balloons or is this real policy? Because the latest now is that basically they could lower the threshold for the higher rate of tax that would draw more people into paying that higher tax. That's a really painful prospect for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think there's definitely kind of pitch rolling going on here, by which we mean, you know, setting up people's expectations so that when these painful measures come, it's not that much of a surprise, it's all been digested, and hopefully you kind of surprise to the upside by perhaps not going as far as have been briefed in the press, and you kind of create some kind of positive narrative. But it's exceptionally tricky around what's essentially a fiscal tightening moment, an austerity moment. I think that what we're hearing is, broadly speaking, what we're going to get from Hunt. So lots of these kind of stealth tax increases where you don't put the headline rate up, but you do things like, you say, cut thresholds, cut allowances, so more people are dragged into these tax brackets. It's a kind of spy way of doing it, but it does raise money for the Treasury. Yeah, I think that's he can lean on that heavily, plus obviously spending cuts, so, you know, cutting departmental budgets. That'll be painful.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so Guy and I were talking about taxes earlier to the dismay of our entire team, who were probably bored to tears, and I just couldn't get over that potentially people who make less than £150,000 a year will be paying 45% taxes. I genuinely don't understand how you guys buy stuff in the UK because of that, and like how growth isn't going to come to a complete halt if that is lowered.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the big challenge Hunt has. He has to try and pick the mix of measures which is going to do least damage to the, you know, real economy whilst also raising revenue for the Treasury and plugging that fiscal hole. Oh, it's not easy for sure. And, you know, in this cost of living crisis, you know, tax increases will hurt. But clearly he thinks that this is a way that, you know, it will be the job for him. But, you know, there are no easy choices here for this Chancellor and this Prime Minister.
Crazy.
In terms of cuts, are we going to be able to see cuts happening at a time when strikes are also picking up? What impact will nurses striking, do you think, have on this government?
I mean, that could be exceptionally debilitating. I mean, you know, conservative record on the NHS is always something that's closely scrutinised by the public. And if it's the case that, you know, care isn't being given because of that strike, you know, the Tories will get a lot of blame for that, and that they can't really afford that electorally. So, yeah, that's a really damaging prospect.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot. Really wonderful. The drip, drip, drip of higher taxes just feels so painful. Joe Mays, really appreciate it. Thank you very much. We'll talk more about Ukraine coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. News that crossed over the last few hours, in case you missed it, had to do with Russia and Ukraine. Apparently, Russia has ordered its troops to leave Ukraine's city of Kherson. That is the first major regional center that was seized in its initial invasion. If true, it's a highly symbolic setback for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, the key part there is if it's true. We talked to people over the last couple hours in TV that said it has not yet been confirmed by Ukraine, and that is pivotal to sort of moving this story forward. So let's get more insight here with Roz Matheson, Bloomberg Executive Editor for International Government. She joined us now from D.C. on my time frame. I love that. Roz, what did you make of the news when it broke, and what do you think it's going to take for us to confirm that it's true?
Well, it's interesting because for a couple of weeks now, at least, Russian troops have already been moving from one bank of this incredibly important river in Ukraine to the other, and that's, you know, to the eastern shore, which is sort of further away from the center of this city. And that's been acknowledgement for some weeks that their troops are dealing with a lot of difficulties in terms of their supply lines being cut, not having access to ammunition and so on, and being under pressure from this continued Ukrainian counteroffensive as we get into the winter months there. And so this is really a sort of a formal acknowledgement of the reality on the ground, and that is that the Russian troops are struggling to hold this city, which was the first major one they occupied after their invasion in February, and they're having to make a tactical withdrawal to do so. I mean, Russia says it's sort of like a planned withdrawal. Ukraine would call it the fact they're being forced out of the city. Again, it doesn't mean that they're retreating further from that area. They're going to sit on the other side of the riverbank, at least for now. But it does really mean they're acknowledging that they cannot hold that city any longer, and they're having to kind of shore up the rest of the territory that they're occupying, most particularly Crimea, which they annexed back in 2014.
Yeah. How vulnerable would Crimea be if the Ukrainian forces do retake Kherson?
Well, it certainly does give Ukraine, the Ukrainian forces, more of a beachhead there. But of course, Russia's occupied Crimea rather since 2014. They've got a lot of troops there. They've got an established military presence there, and that really is the one place that Vladimir Putin does not want to cede, because that would take him back to pre-2014. Not only could he not hold the territory that they've occupied since the invasion this year, but they couldn't hold on to Crimea also, and that's really the jewel in the crown for him. And so this is probably an effort to really reinforce Crimea and to put a bunch of Russian troops in the way.
A guy asked this question on TV, and I thought it was a really good one, which is, if this is confirmed to be true, is this what Ukraine should start negotiating from?
Well, that is the question. Of course, though, Ukraine does insist that they're in no position or interest at this point still to negotiate. They will only negotiate with Russia on certain terms, and that requires the full withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukrainian territory, including Ukraine, and for now that Crimea, and that for now that's unlikely to happen. So you don't see an environment as yet where Russia and Ukraine are ready to sit down together and discuss this. Certainly, for the Russian president, this is another setback, and he needs to find a way to come into any talks really with some advantages, because it's not in his interest to be negotiating either on the back foot. So it's probably not at the point yet where either side's really ready to sit down.
What's happening with the weather in Ukraine right now? Are we into the kind of the wet, soggy bits? Are we starting to get to the point where it's cold and you can start using mechanized forces sort of across fields, etc.? Because this is seen as being a crucial kind of pass in this war as we go into the second winter.
Well, that's right. And we are heading into that kind of more difficult terrain where we get very muddy conditions in the area. And so this could have been sort of the last significant push by Ukraine for a while to get Russia out of Kherson, because at this point, probably the fighting's going to slow down to some extent because of the challenges of the terrain on both sides. You've been seeing that happening elsewhere in Ukraine in recent weeks. And, you know, Russia has lost a lot of manpower and they've lost a lot of military gear, but so has Ukraine, even if they're being resupplied by the US and other allies. They're running low on things like ammunition and so on. And so you can see an environment where this conflict does slow to some extent on the ground in the coming months, and particularly also because Russia has had success in cutting off energy infrastructure in Ukraine and getting sort of hitting electricity and power going into winter. And that's certainly going to have an effect on Ukraine either way.
Did Ukraine just breathe a sigh of relief with the midterms here in the U.S.? Did this sort of cement support from the U.S. going forward?
Well, it's interesting because we actually met with the Ukrainian economy minister here in DC yesterday. She's in town and she's sort of talking with the US government about practical measures to support the economy in Ukraine. We asked her that question, was she worried about the midterm elections and if Republicans sort of take the House, that they'll be less willing to continue to provide financial aid. And her answer to that was a firm no. They said they're not concerned because they do see bipartisan support for the effort in Ukraine. The reality, though, is that as the war does go on, and it's not really just a question for the US, but it's also for Europe, as we potentially get around to the one-year mark of this conflict in February 2023, do you see just sort of fatigue continue to creep in terms of the level of financial support? Do you see conditions being attached to the money that's going in? That's sort of a natural question you can expect from everywhere. But certainly, she was confident that there was not going to be a shift in position, yep, no matter the makeup of Congress.
Well, let's look at that another way. Is there an expectation, is there a growing sense in DC that the Europeans need to step up and provide more?
Well, certainly there's been criticism of the European Union because a lot of the money they pledged months and months ago has not actually yet been released to Ukraine. It's sort of bound up in the bureaucracy of the conversations within the European Union. And they've been talking this week about extra money going in, but they haven't even gotten the previous amounts to flow into Ukraine to keep the government functioning. So that's been a criticism by both Kiev and the US, that the EU does need to step up on that front. But more broadly, of course, like, Europe has been supplying a lot of military aid alongside the US and has sent a lot of weaponry in and provided other humanitarian aid. But there is that sense that perhaps some of the unity in Europe about financial support for Ukraine is starting to weaken.
Roz, thank you very much indeed. We always appreciate the updates and the analysis. Bloomberg's Roz Matheson joining us from Washington, D.C. In a moment, we'll be back to Bitcoin. Bitcoin has just had another break below 17,000. We'll talk about the details when we come back. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. Let's get a check in here on U.S. markets because we're definitely seeing a risk-off theme here. You're seeing money flowing into the dollar, into the bond market in Europe and here in the U.S. and out of equities and, you know, out of Bitcoin. Quite frankly, 16,899 is where Bitcoin is trading. Tech getting hit pretty hard. You can see the line from there to Bitcoin. Disney also apparently erasing almost all of its pandemic gains after it missed on earnings. And it wasn't just streaming. It was also the outlook for its parks and SeaWorld that left a lot of question marks out there. Anyway, we're going to talk about Bitcoin in just a minute. And if there's a contagion effect here, we got to pay attention to. But in the meantime, let's get some other stories with Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. Nurses in England, Wales, and Scotland have voted to strike in the biggest course of industrial action in the Royal College of Nursing's 106-year history. In a fresh blow to the UK's already strained National Health Service, the majority of nurses employed by the NHS are supporting action over patients' safety concerns and as they seek a pay rise of 5% above inflation. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt is considering hitting more Britons with the top rate of income tax as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government seeks ways to stabilize UK's public finances. Sources say Hunt is thinking about lowering the £150,000 threshold at which the 45% higher rate of income tax is paid. Newspapers including The Sun and Mail first reported Hunt was considering the move. Twitter rolled out a new official badge for high-profile accounts and then, just as quickly, scrapped the program with Elon Musk saying the company would do further experiments under his ownership. In a tweet, Musk said, quote, "Please note that Twitter will do lots of dumb things in coming months," adding, "We will keep what works and change what doesn't." The short-lived official badge was used to label government figures, businesses, major media outlets, and some public figures. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right, Charlie Pellett, thank you very much. Let's get back to what's happening with Bitcoin. $16,978 is where we're trading. The blow-up of FTX over the last couple days ended yesterday in Binance offering to buy the company. Now, CoinDesk is saying that maybe that won't happen. Also, you have U.S. regulators are looking into the relationship of the FTX U.S. platform and its relationship with Alameda, which is SBF's Sam Bankman-Fried's hedge fund. So there are a lot more questions circulating here, and you could argue that that's putting a lot more pressure on overall markets. There's really only one person to talk to. That's Shanali Basak, who joins me now in studio. Shanali, what should we book? So many different questions. But right now, what is Bitcoin trading on?
So, listen, when the FTX debacle happened, for a while, months now, whether it was Sam Bankman-Fried himself or Mike Novogratz, whose own firm stock is down more than 20% today, you had all of these large investors saying, the leverage is out of the system. There are no liquidity issues. The worst is over. And so now you see one of the, a way bigger issue this year than you've seen all year in the crypto markets. And it's left a lot of people reeling about what else are we not seeing? Mm-hmm. How much money do they have left to keep handling within the system? Do they trust the consolidation that's happening in the industry as more players get more power? There are existential questions that pervade the industry, not just about FTX, but the investors who have had exposure to FTX and now the crypto markets more largely. But, you know, honestly, still above 16,000. It's not a full crash in Bitcoin, but you do see a lot of damage done in the industry right now.
In terms of how regulators are going to perceive all this, what this just once again highlights is the lack of transparency, the lack of clarity about what happens in this market. Is this going to be a further catalyst for action?
Yes. In the short answer, yes. We've reported, we have a scoop led by Lydia Bayoud, that certain U.S. regulators, the SEC, CFTC, are trying to figure out what has happened to lead FTX to the brink in this manner. The SEC probe really started months ago because they were thinking about the FTX U.S. lending activities. But remember, a lot of FTX is outside of the United States. And so when Bloomberg Television Emily Chang spoke yesterday to the Coinbase CEO, one big point that he made was, listen, we have so much lack of clarity here. It's pushed exchanges outside of the U.S., other large players outside of the U.S., and guess what? It's harder to keep a handle on it when it's not in your jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. I think what's also interesting is a lot of questions around kind of the relationship of stablecoins to the crypto industry. Circle is one of the companies that had some relationships with FTX. The CEO of Circle, it's a company that wants to go public, went to Twitter and really kind of backed up the fact that they have a lot of their assets backed by treasuries and that they custody with Bank of New York Mellon. Those are two big things that are part of the traditional financial system that we know every day. So it makes you question, what does the future of digital assets look like? Is it just a bunch of digital dollars, or is it this thing that has just kind of captured the hearts and imaginations of an entirely new generation of traders?
For all the big money that's in it, like all the hedge funds, et cetera, what do they want it to be? Like, what are they buying when they're, you know, investing, when Tiger's investing, yeah, or Novogratz is investing in FTX?
A few things. I think that there was an excitement around an idea that money didn't need to be controlled by banks. Money didn't need to be controlled by central banks. And the idea that technology can be a beautiful way to disintermediate the system and could make it potentially more fair for a lot of people, maybe more profitable as it had been for so many years. And again, remember, it's more than $16,000. People who got in years ago are pretty all right. It's just the last couple of years that have been really difficult. But, you know, to your point, the billionaire backers to FTX, you've got to wonder if this has dented their faith in the system. These are people like Paul Tudor Jones's family. It is people like Third Point, the hedge fund really run by Dan Loeb. It's Tiger Global, SoftBank, Temasek, like huge Ontario Teachers, huge investors across the world. Iconic, which is the firm that was known to be the firm that ran money for Mark Zuckerberg early on and is now a huge asset manager. So, yes, do they continue to play in this space when one of the most trusted names has gone under?
Is there a wider effect of all of this into other asset classes?
That's an interesting question, because there has been a correlation. that's not a causation, right? There has been a correlation between how crypto, especially Bitcoin, trades and the NASDAQ, for example. To the extent that the last couple of years you saw a lot of retail money really being hurt by a lot of the stock market pain and the pain in cryptocurrencies, yeah, your marginal buyer is really stung. That has real impacts. I don't know if you remember this, but during the meme stock frenzy, was it 2020? The retail investors accounted for as much as 25% on the most active trading days of the U.S. stock market.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's according to Citadel Securities.
Yeah.
And so one of the biggest market makers. So yeah, you know, Citadel gets paid off the back of those volumes. So it does impact, you know, the money made by the real financial system and does impact retails and the ability to buy into markets at scale.
Yeah, there is another narrative that, like, maybe some of the speculative froth was already taken out in the summer when this happened, and then maybe the Fed's been successful in draining that a bit, so it won't be as bad.
One interesting thing I would just say, too, because there's a lot of conversation about how Binance might back out of its, you know, initial intent to buy FTX assets outside of the United States. Yuechi Yang, who is just a brilliant reporter for us on market structure and crypto, according to people familiar with the matter, the gap between liabilities and assets at FTX could be more than $6 billion.
Whoa.
Where is that $6 billion is what I want to know.
I don't know.
Where
is it?
$6 billion? I don't know.
Wow. Okay, that's a serious hole. All right, hey, Shanali, thanks a lot. This is not the last time we're going to be talking about this. Shanali Bastic joining us there. Coming up, job cuts, Meta, it's happening. We'll talk about it. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. Meta shares responding fairly positively to news that we've all been anticipating. We are going to see job cuts at the company that formerly was known as Facebook. 11,000 jobs in the first major round of layoffs for this social media giant. We did see Mr. Zuckerberg, of course, talking about his responsibility for this a little earlier, talking about the fact that, quote, I got this wrong. His words. Alex Borinka joins us now to talk about this. Alex, this is a growth stock. This is a company that's meant to be expanding and growing. Can it be a growth stock if it's cutting staff?
I mean, that is what they're hoping for, that they can refocus and find that growth. Meta has gone through just a really, really tough year in its core social media business, which depends on ads. And as Mark Zuckerberg said in the note, they expected that business to be growing at a more accelerated clip, that all of the time and the money that folks were spending shopping online during the pandemic would continue in a post-lockdown world. But that just hasn't happened. So that kind of big bet that he made, that growth in headcount, a 28% growth in headcount over the last year, he said himself he got it wrong. And unfortunately, that means that, you know, 13% of the workforce is taking the hit.
Alex, hey, welcome back. It's so great to that you're with us again. Alex worked for Bloomberg for a while, went to another shop and came back, and I was so thrilled to see your name on the rundown. Hi.
Hi. I'm so happy to be back.
Yes.
A dismal day, but an important one.
Fair enough. Okay, so back to Mark being like, I'm so sorry. Has he done enough at this point?
Some investors would argue that he hasn't. You'll remember Altimeter Capital put out a letter a few weeks ago saying you should cut headcount, you should rein in spending on this big future bet on virtual reality, which they call the metaverse, and you should really kind of focus in more. The company talked today that they're going to be doing some business restructuring, and they're going to continue focusing on those key development areas around AI and around ads and the metaverse, which should be growth. So I think some folks would argue that maybe there's more to do, but Mark said that this was their last resort, firing people. So I think that tension will probably continue over the next few quarters here as people kind of scrutinize what they're spending on and where that extra growth is going to come from.
Reality Labs is not being touched by this, but that's where investors would like to see some of the cuts coming through and the spending to be reduced. Is Zuckerberg listening to investors here?
He is.
seems to be digging his heels in that he believes that virtual reality is the future of the internet. So Reality Labs is that development of metaverse piece. It takes $1 of every $10 of revenue that Meta makes goes to fund the build out of this future. So he is really digging in his heels. You know, he renamed the company after a year ago and seems to be really committed to that. We don't have any specific news as to if there's going to be any additional cost cuts there. They reaffirmed today that the spending will continue into next year, but we didn't quite get specifics if it's still going to be around that $10 billion a year level that has been over the past 24 months.
I guess it's really hard for me to understand how they can grow or at least be profitable in this environment when the macro is also a headwind and they have to pump a lot of money into this thing that won't be profitable for a long time. It just feels like that's 2 plus 2 equals 12.
That is his math that he's asking investors to bet on, but they're not buying it. You know, 16 months ago, this was a trillion dollar market cap company. That's fallen by about 75%. So, yes, that 2 plus 2 equals 12 is the math that's sort of being laid out here, saying, you know, you got to be a believer. You got to bet on this future, this bet that I'm making. But when you see him come out in moments like today and say, look, I was wrong about this latest bet on what we think people are going to do, spending more time online like they did during the pandemic, I think those questions do come up for the long term, even if today folks are happy that they're cutting costs based on these headcount decreases.
All right, Alex, thanks a lot. I know you've been back for like over a year, but this is like the highlight of my week right now is like talking to you. We will definitely be making you come on more TV and everything. Alex, thanks a lot. Alex Barinka joining us on Facebook. And then it makes it feel like Mark Zuckerberg saying sorry just feels a little hollow then at that point. All right, coming up, we're going to take a look at CPI for tomorrow. Do we see any cooling? What does even cooling look like at this point? And how's the market prepped? We'll get that take. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
This slow return to normal levels of inflation could threaten the stability of inflation expectations. And if there's one thing we learned in the 70s is that the Fed cannot let inflation fester and expectations rise. If we back off for fear of a downturn, inflation comes back even stronger and requires even more restraint.
Thomas Barkin, the Richmond Fed president, speaking a little bit earlier on, this ahead of tomorrow's CPI print out of the United States. Inflation is expected to slow, but not significantly. This is the first of two prints we will get before the December meeting of the Federal Reserve. 50-75, obviously the big discussion as to how far the Fed is going to go, 0.5%, 0.75%. Joining us now, as ever, ahead of the numbers, Bloomberg's Mike McKee. Mike, what does a slight slowing in inflation do, and how will it change the picture for the Fed, if at all?
A lot of it, Guy, is going to depend on the composition of what happens, which categories are rising, which categories are falling. One thing the Fed is going to be looking at is the progress that is being made on the categories that are affected. In other words, they're not going to worry too much about energy prices because they can't do anything about that. They'd like to see food prices come down. There's some indications that food prices could be leveling off or coming down. It was certainly good news that the Ukrainian grain shipments weren't really interrupted. But it's services categories, things like that, that the Fed's going to be looking to. And if they do see some movement in those categories, they will feel better than they necessarily would if we don't get a major move in the headline numbers of headline or core.
So if that's the case, what do you think the market is prepped for right now?
I think the market is probably prepped for sort of what we're anticipating. Slight rise in the headline number because of energy and a slight drop in the core rate, which would be, you know, the kind of thing that if your policy is working, you'd expect to see over time, a sort of sequential decline. Now, the thing about inflation is it's normally a long buildup, long drop down process. It came on us much more quickly this time, in part because of the stimulus programs, in part because of energy and the combined effect that had on psychology, along with the fact that companies had to spend more money to get people to come back to work. So there's a possibility that it could drop more quickly, but the Fed's going to look at it as this is going to be a slow process, and they're not going to be upset if we get some small declines, but it takes a while to work its way through the economy.
Does this data matter as much as the next set of data when it comes to deciding how the Fed is going to react in December? How are they going to think about these two numbers in concert?
Well, what will matter about these numbers is what the market thinks of these numbers and how the market sets up for the Fed because of these numbers. As you mentioned, we get another CPI report. It is literally just before the Fed meeting to decide. Is that going to be enough time to influence anybody there? I don't know. We will get the PCE numbers at the end of November before the Fed meets. And those are they have a different composition because of the way they are put together than the CPI. They'll have less of a downdraft from medical care costs and less of an updraft from homes. And the Fed is looking to bring down the PCE numbers to 2%, not the CPI. So it's a shorter journey with different compositions. So that may actually matter more than what the CPI tells us tomorrow.
In terms of what the Fed needs to see in terms of, say, cooling or rolling over, how many months at what kind of decline? Do we know with specificity what that looks like?
No, and that's deliberate on their part.
I mean, they haven't told us six months at this kind of decline?
It's the old Potter Stewart definition of obscenity. I can't tell you what it is, but I know it when I see it. Mm-hmm. They want to see an ongoing sequential decline in the month-to-month rate of inflation. The headline numbers are always influenced by what happened 12 months prior, so that doesn't really matter as much as what's happening right now in the most immediate month going forward. So keep an eye on those. But the Fed is not putting a timetable on this. Where it will come into play is in the first quarter of next year and how the sequential numbers move. If they go down, that will start to influence the Fed in terms of how high they have to go and how quickly they have to get there. And they may, they've suggested 5%, so you look to March as a sort of inflection point of whether at that point they're going to be stopping their rate increases or if they're going to need to do more. We'll have a much better idea because I think somebody said there's 5 CPI reports between now and then.
In terms of the market setup into this, we have repriced significantly since the last press conference. Would tomorrow just be confirmation of what Powell told us last time around, or do you think it's going to be new information?
A little bit of both. It's going to be new information, as I said earlier, when you look into the categories and whether the things that should be falling are falling. But in terms of pricing the market, unless there's a really outsized surprise, it shouldn't change the markets too much. One thing, the top line numbers on CPI, economists are pretty good at forecasting. We don't usually get a huge surprise, although it can happen. So if you're, you know, setting up your trades on the top line, you know, you probably aren't going to have a big thing to worry about. We'll see if it makes a significant change in the way people are looking at things. I think not, because it's still so long until we get to the...
All right, Mike, thank you. Appreciate it. No doubt we'll have you on tomorrow as well. Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. And to that point, Guy, there was a fun article out about a J.P. Morgan that kind of tried to game all the scenarios out. And two that stuck out to me is that if the CPI falls to 7.6 or below... not that that's going to happen, but you could see equities surge more than 5% and the 10-year going below 4. If it's a super hot number, stocks could fall as much as 6%. So it feels in some ways kind of binary. And are we really protecting for upside? Maybe we're protecting for downside, but are we protecting for upside?
It's going to be a busy day, isn't it? It's going to be another busy day.
He sounds so thrilled.
I do. I'm trying to game out tomorrow and think about what I'm going to be focusing on. This crypto story is not going away either. Tomorrow has the potential for some real bumps. It's going to be a fascinating journey, I think, tomorrow. Join us for the coverage. It's going to be great. This is Bloomberg.